I've been here like a week and a half, and it's been rainbow time. And last week especially, there were a fair number of black preachers and others leading sessions. And somewhere along the line, the question of friendships, of bridges across cultures came up in a variety of different ways. And when it came time to figure out what kind of presentations I might be making, I thought I'd like to speak from basically personal experience about some examples of what I consider to be natural and healthy bridges across races and cultures, and we can go from there. A little bit about myself. I trained for the ministry a long time ago. I was kind of in the middle of being a little uncomfortable in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I happen to have been Irish and left-handed, and in a variety of other ways didn't exactly feel real at home in that context. And I was debating. I actually completed what Missouri calls a vicarage or an internship, and was debating whether I actively wanted to pursue ordination or not, or do other things, and took a cab driving job. And I had done my internship in Sacramento, California, and shortly thereafter I had made some contacts around the Capitol, and shortly thereafter I started working in the California legislature as an administrative assistant to a then assemblywoman. She's now California Secretary of State, March Fong Yu. And some interesting things. I love the job, and have been involved in a lot of other political things, but some interesting things happened to me personally, especially when I was working in the legislature. Where it's real easy to be wined and dined, at least in those days, without ever having to worry about who's paying for the meals. And a lot of sitting at desks, at meetings, at hearings, and in the particular case where I was, when the assemblywoman represented a district that was Oakland and Castro Valley, and the legislature's in Sacramento, about 90 miles away, an awful lot of sitting in cars going back and forth. I remember one particular day when I made the round trip three times, and that's why I'm chairman of the California Reformed Anti-Sedentary Society, which our initials are CRASS, and our slogan is "Get off your ass and support CRASS." But anyway, there were things happening with me personally that I was becoming increasingly out of shape. I had played some basketball when I was in high school and college in these small Lutheran schools, and loved the game, but after I was out of school and sort of had no particular context to play basketball or exercise in other ways, I didn't. And I got quite heavy, quite flabby, out of shape, and some of the other things that go with it. Not only backaches and that sort of thing, but aggressive, or not having a healthy outlet for aggression, and you do things like get crabby with your spouse and not feel very good about yourself and about life. And not too long after that, I got a job at the University of California at Berkeley as a researcher, editor, and I wasn't real crazy about the job. It was in the industrial relations area, and you dealt with a lot of trivia about cost of living allowances and grievance procedures. And although a lot of the people I worked with professionally had spent much of their life and were fascinated by those things, I couldn't get really into it too much. But the university had a gymnasium, and I started going over there with some of my colleagues kind of after work every day, and sometimes before work and sometimes at lunch, and started playing basketball. Whenever we could, almost. And in the process, I lost 65 pounds. I got in much better shape, and found out I was a much better basketball player than I ever thought I would be. The funding for that particular position was based on a federal grant, and that grant ran out, and I was no longer there, no longer had access to the gym, and I survived by doing some freelance speech writing and humor writing and some freelance writing and just a variety of consulting type things. But I really wanted to make sure that I got back into, or got a regular place to play full court basketball, which I really liked. And I'm going to read you something I wrote, which describes something that happened to me personally in my life, which was, in my opinion, a wonderful example of a natural bridge across cultures. I think I'll sit while I read this, and it's slightly long, so I'll try and read it kind of quickly. Darryl wondered who the white dude was, this is in the third person, incidentally, sitting under a tree near the basketball court reading a book. Somehow he didn't think he was a cop or a narc. Cops and narcs almost never come to the basketball court. Even they seem to have some respect for territory, if nothing else. This was Darryl's turf. He and his young blood hooping partners had grown up nearby San Antonio Park in the East Oakland flatlands, reflecting its neighborhood well, both in its rainbow nature and its clear divisions. The basketball court was virtually an exclusive haven for bloods. The rest of the park showed the variety in the area. Chicanos and other Latinos played soccer on the big field, while somewhere young blacks played touch football. Below the basketball court, Asian refugees would sometimes play a strange version of volleyball with a small rubbery ball that they would kick or bounce off their heads. Whatever turns them on, Darryl mused, different kicks with different picks. Elsewhere in the park, all sorts of people would picnic and drink beer, or sometimes just drink. Parents and kids of all types peopled the slides and swings in the playground. People with nice car came to play tennis. They convinced the city mothers to build two new courts. Once the hard-to-destroy chain nets came down off the bent hoop rims, however, they were not replaced. Darryl was known as the squirrel in the local menagerie of monikers. He was short, quick, and had those stutter-step moves that made him as easy to guard as it is to catch a squirrel. And to make this indigenous, I guess I should mention chipmunks as well. I met one named Thelonious the other day. He was very muscular, but when the stranger came to the court, they tended not to take him serious. Because of his 5'5" stature. Once they saw his game, though, he quickly commanded respect and provoked expletivic expressions. That mother could shoot hoop. He was very proud of his game and especially proud of his speed and strength. It was on a Monday afternoon that Darryl first saw the white dude. He was hairy, wearing three or four green and white headbands around his head and neck. Darryl later learned that he had his long hair and bushy beard because of his firm belief in the hirsute of happiness. Four of Darryl's friends arrived about the same time he did. It was about 1:30 when serious hoopsters often began to gather. Some were high school buddies, the rest park regulars. Rue was there, nicknamed because of his ever-hoppin' hoopin' moves, worthy of any kangaroo. Garbage Man was also there. He got his name because of his garbagey rebounds and loose balls he picked up and converted into baskets with equally garbagey shots. Everyone shot around for a while, thinking about getting a game going. The white dude asked if he could run with Darryl's team, as sides were being chosen. Why not, thought Darryl, one more player after all was needed for 3-on-3. The players soon learned that the interloper played unlike any white dude they had ever seen. For one thing, he was not afraid to get physical and mix it with the bloods. He was most willing to throw his broad-shouldered body around. Being somewhat overweight gave him just enough padding as he banged off whatever player he encountered under the backboards. What really captured attention, though, was how this guy could handle the ball, pass, fade, and put up this crazy left-handed hook shot. Often, as soon as he got the ball, and although he had the white man's disease of being unable to jump noticeably, he got a lot of rebounds by positioning and steals with his quick hands. He'd whip an imaginative pass past unsuspecting defenders to an equally surprised teammate. Sometimes it would be a behind-the-back bounce pass. Other times he'd fake the sinister hook of his and lob a quick pass to an open man sneaking through the proverbial back door. The squirrel was quick to note these things, as well as the stranger's fearless drives, often being especially deadly with a running hook. At first, defenders often just watched him with his unusual moves, standing there bemused. But as the ball kept going into the basket, or as he kept passing to teammates with proverbial pinpoint accuracy, they started to take seriously the task of stopping this new force. They started to guard him strongly to the left, but he'd spin and dance by them, often using a behind-the-back dribble, followed by a crazy underhand scoop shot. Soon the sacred names of Koozie, Earl the Pearl, and Clyde were being invoked in honor of this unsuspected portrait of an artist as a middle-aged hoopster. The first day, the Squirrels team with the new recruit won every game, both half and full court. They were natural partners, both delighting in the sheer unlikeliness of their own games and each other's. The Squirrel also got some blockbuster screens, worthy of the most skilled tight ends. The Squirrel loved them. A lot of hoopin' bloods don't like picks, or concomitant rolls for that matter, because it's something more macho to go one-on-one, but Darryl thought it was smart hoop. Scat backs would have as much fun with blocking backs as scat singers can have with bassy blues. The white dude came back every day that week, allowing primal basketball to wipe out many of the frustrations of the never-never land of consulting, freelancing, and remembering. No one questioned his welcome. No one asked his name, or what he did, or where he came from. The court was like that, a haven for the unemployed, those just out of jail, or what have you. They just came for hoop. Once, after the white dude did a spectacular coast-to-coast number which ended with a crossover dribble, hand fake, and 360-degree turnaround hook shot, successful, of course, the squirrel shouted out, "Silky." After another smooth move, an outrageously fine pass, the term was completed. Soon it became his nickname among Silk and his ilk. Whenever he first heard it, he acted as though the clouds had opened and a great voice had called from the heavens. Silk, he took his annunciatory epiphany with the greatest equanimity, for not far away, naysaying from his grave, was an equine relative, Silky Sullivan, a horse that clearly is a relative of mine. We share a lot of traits, with whom he shared many energizing traits, once again bursting forth uncontrolled, but oh so silky from the starting gate. I read you this because it was the start of an extraordinary number of friendships in my life. I long had a fair number of, quote, black friends. I was active in civil rights in early 60s, and when I worked in the legislature, I often dealt with what you might call leadership blacks, people involved in civil rights organizations or in governmental jobs or what have you. But this was quite different. These were real, plain street bloods, and many of them unemployed, some out of jail, what have you. And they were just people who liked basketball. And I didn't know a soul when I went to that park. Now I'm probably, at least by name, the best known playground basketball player in Oakland. I mean, they all know my name. I'm white and I have this name, and they might not all know each other's name. Just a fair number of really close friendships developed out of that, and a basic point of it all is that there was something extraordinarily natural about it. Way back in the 60s, when the civil rights stuff was first happening, I remember very well Lenny Bruce used to have a wonderful comic routine called How to Please Your Colored Friends at a Party. And it was all sorts of funny stuff about people going up to a black and saying things like, "That Joe Louis is a hell of a fighter, isn't he?" Or talk about watermelons and lots of other stereotypes that whites at that time and still today often have of blacks. That often is unnatural. And there are few things that are resented more or achieved less friendly, if that's a word, by blacks than whites who are trying real hard to befriend a black. It's phony as a proverbial $3 bill often, and it's picked up real quickly. But I suspect that all of you might well, and I'm not sure what it might be around, who knows, but might have places where you can build natural bridges across races, and I think it's extraordinarily important. There was a fair amount of talk this week about institutionalized racism, about how structures and laws and corporations and all that are involved in that, and of course, those are real serious problems. But I suspect that a lot of progress really also relates to personal racism and how we learn to make friends across races ourselves in ways that are natural. I'd like to now play a tape for you about another interesting example. This is where the jazzy Lutherans come in, of bridges that are natural that have been built around across the races in a church in Oakland. It's Bethlehem Lutheran Church. The pastor, many of you may know, is Will Hertzfeld, the former presiding bishop of the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches, and his wife Tress has often been up here and in fact was in charge of Rainbow Week until unfortunately she had to go into surgery last week. The church is real interesting in that it's about 65 or 70% American black. It originated from a black congregation in New Orleans, curiously, which was on the other end of the Southern Pacific line. And as Pullman car porters settled in West Oakland, some of the first blacks to live there in what used to be good white German Lutheran turf, the church itself was once Ed Meese's boyhood church until his family and other white families decided to buy some property up in the hills in Piedmont and move the church and sell it to these blacks, and unfortunately stripping it of its organ and quite a few other things that could be stripped of it. Another 10 or 15% of the congregation is African. We have a number of South Africans, including Molefe Modise, who was here last week. And we also have people from Zaire and Eritrea and Cameroons and Ethiopia and some other parts of Africa, and at various times in the past there have been a fair number of Namibians there. It's about maybe 15 to 20% white, including both what might be called special people, people who are living in a group home for, I guess you might call it, adult mentally retarded nearby, to some quite sophisticated people who are lawyers and physicians and journalists and so forth. And there are also people from the Philippines and a woman who was born in Germany, and it's a real curious mix of people. And I sometimes like to kid the pastor, Will Hertzfeld, because he himself has kind of a multicultural name. I mean, Hertzfeld sounds much more Lutheran than O'Sullivan, for example, and it also sounds mildly Jewish in some people's minds, and he, of course, has the first name of Willie, so I guess that makes him personally multicultural. And we do a lot of different music there. My wife was has been a church musician in white churches, white Lutheran churches, much of her life. She's been an organist since the age of 4 and a half. And so a few years ago, she celebrated 40 years of being a church organist, I think at the age of 44 or 45. But Will asked her to come down there and be the music director, and where her own interest in music have gone from classical and Bach and all that to jazz. She plays piano with a 17-piece big band and other jazz groups. It has been just fascinating, the type of musical bridges that are real natural that have been going on within the parish. But at the same time, it's a parish that does a lot with spirituals and some with gospel music. and a lot with jazz. We also do a lot with Bach. Last month when Bach, Handel, and Heinrich Schütz were honored in the Lutheran Book of Worship, as happens in many places, we did an entirely Bach service. And although some of it was a little jazzy, some of the Bach was played on vibraphone and trombone, it is as natural in this multicultural parish to play Bach as it is to play jazz and some of the other things. I'd like to play you one number. The number is Precious Lord by Thomas Dorsey. If you heard T. Wyatt Walker's videotape the other day about black music, Dorsey's often known as the father of modern gospel music. He originally was a jazz and kind of honky-tonk pianist who had some experiences in his life that converted him to Christianity and playing and composing gospel music. This particular song, Precious Lord, was Martin Luther King Jr.'s favorite song, and it was like a number of other great hymns. I think of Isaac Watts's When the Cross of Christ Thy Glory. It was written in under the cloud of tragedy. Dorsey, the day before, had lost his wife and two children in an automobile accident, I believe it was. Anyway, this is the choir of Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Oakland with some jazz musicians. A couple of them are, you might call, guest musicians, and some are right from that parish. I think you'll enjoy it. Thank you. it's been pretty fascinating to watch what goes on in that congregation, because the music has just been infectious, taking off, number of people hearing about it and coming there, and next thing they know they're recruited into the choir. The Herzfeld accuses my wife of, much like Holden, where everyone's expected to be in the choir when they get up here, of trying to make sure that the entire downstairs of the church is filled with the choir, and maybe a few people can be in the balcony who don't yet respond to the call. What is also fascinating about it is the multiracial nature of it. Anybody want to speculate about what they may have thought the races of the musicians were? Piano player is white, it's my wife. The clarinet player, Clarence Warren, is black. I'm blown away every time I hear the clarinet solos on this tape. He's used to play with Duke Ellington and Lena Horne and Jay McShann, and plays when Broadway shows come to San Francisco, he's often in the Pitt Orchestra. And he and my wife and his choir never practiced together. The choir, of course, practiced, but he never practiced with them, and my wife and he had never played together, and yet it sounds like they had for a long time. The trombonist is white, in fact, a former Navy doctor at Oakdale Hospital. Drummer was white, the jazz drummer type. There are other drums going on there that are conga and African type drums. I think there were three of them. They were all black. The choir members are probably about 75% black, and the rest white, with, although more recently, an Asian woman has joined. And I'm saying this because in one way it doesn't matter at all, but in another way it matters a lot, because here is an exciting bridge across cultures that is happening, that's working, and also is natural. Just like for me the basketball thing was real natural, this is, it's just happening. And music and sports are probably the finest places, or the main places in American culture, where real bridges across races are becoming increasingly natural. In sports, when I was a kid, I was a little unusual in that some of my sports heroes were black. I used to be a Chicago White Sox fan and loved Minnie Minoso, who happened to be a black Cuban playing for him. The Giants moved to San Francisco, and we were blessed with Willie Mays and Willie McCovey, who played the game with extraordinary grace and ability. And for you trivia freaks, Willie Mays, Willie McCovey, and Will Hertzfeld were all born in Alabama at about the same time. Let's see. Of blacks and whites shaping a new music in this country happened early in the century, when jazz came out of ragtime, came out of the black community, and all of a sudden Benny Goodman and Tommy Dorsey and lots of other folk were picking up what essentially was a black music. And I think there's a lot of hope in this. In a state like California, which by the year 2000 will be 50% third world, I think it's not only hopeful, but it's extraordinarily important that the type of hybrid music that's developing and in other spheres continue to develop. I mentioned that when I was a kid, I had black heroes in basketball, Bill Russell and Casey Jones and that sort of thing. I don't think it's all uncommon for white kids now to have black heroes. It's really wonderful that that's happening. I don't know how many of you are basketball fans. You may have come here out of sheer curiosity of the title today, but if any of you have watched Michael Jordan, he is already the hero of probably millions of young basketball players. If you watch his athletic ability, you think he's a new species. He's just so good, and it's real natural and wonderful that he's becoming an incredibly important symbol to all sorts of young people, black and white and what have you. And that's real helpful and real hopeful, I think. My title also included the term plain white rappers, and some of you may have wondered what that means. I have this terrible tendency to pun, and that was part of it. But what is called rap music is a cultural phenomenon among young people in the last 3 or 4 years in this country that also has been pretty amazing in the way it's cut across cultural boundaries. A group of white, it grew out of black ghettos around New York and Philadelphia especially, and the same culture that brought us breakdancing essentially brought rap music out. And if you haven't heard it, it's often kind of hard on the ears. It's got a lot of heavy electronic sort of beat to it. And it originally was black kind of oral poets, not so much singing as saying, with a lot of bragging and so forth, lines that rhyme with each other. And I'm an English teacher in an inner city school. It's a real healthy thing because for a change, some of the real heroes in the black community are people who are skilled with language. If someone's a deaf rapper, someone who's fine with rhyme, he's real popular, and some of them, like Run DMC and other groups, are making enormous amounts of money. And to show how much rap music has broken into the culture, listen to a lot of commercials on television, and all of a sudden they're rhyming and kind of with a rap rhythm to it. A fascinating part of that is rap music, although it really is very black and grew out of black communities, is also becoming a cross-cultural phenomenon. And one of the most curious parts of that of all is a group called the Beastie Boys. They are white, kind of lower middle class, funky sort of rappers who, curiously, with their own type of rap, have become enormous heroes in the black community. That's wild and crazy, but we are genuinely becoming, through such kind of pop culture things, a much more multiracial and cross-cultural society than we were 10 years ago, or certainly than we were 20 years ago. I think being sensitive to some of those kind of pop phenomenons going on and trying to find ways we can relate to them is also healthy. The final thing I mentioned in my weird title was building rainbow coalitions. We've heard a lot about rainbow, and here I just want to say a few things about the type of coalitions that have been developing politically. Also, I think, are extraordinarily helpful, and they're often built around people that might seem at first glance to be very dissimilar, finding ways in which they share a lot of common self-interest. And once they discover those self-interests together, I think it's enormously positive that coalitions are being built. Some people have been saying that although there's been a lot happening, that racism and so forth have not changed dramatically in this country, and there are signs of ugly and virulent racism appearing in skinheads and other groups that are really scary. But at the same time, it's fascinating when black and white workers in the same plant, where 20 years ago those white workers might have thought those blacks were their enemies because they were trying to get their jobs, are now social friends and political friends and union friends and working together in ways that again become very natural. And I think it's often around questions of self-interest and questions of just looking beyond what used to be categories of race that cut things off to categories of mutuality that help to build coalitions. Again, the word naturalness. People in a meat plant or a lumber mill or what have you are being closed out of their jobs by plant closures or other policies of American life, they share a commonality of interest that far transcends race and has made for, I think, some very interesting and valuable and important coalitions. Well, I hope I've given you some ideas of my own feelings from my personal life and basketball and from a church that's increasingly multicultural and where music is being largely the center of many of those bridges and some of the things that are happening in pop culture and politics to emphasize that we should all try to find natural ways in which we can participate in making for greater understanding and greater justice and a bright, rainbowish, multiculturalist future. Are there responses or questions? Yes.
Question. You talked about naturalness, and we've been for several years in Holden trying this rainbow on the mountain deal, which isn't exactly a natural channel. You've been here during it. I just came in yesterday and I see that we don't have anywhere near as many blacks as we had hoped to have for this week. And I wonder what your observation is, having seen the whole thing.
Yeah, I should say this is my first year here, so I can't really compare with last year. And I was here all of last week and this week, and it's unfortunate that there were a lot of quite high-powered blacks here last week, a number of theological professors and preachers and what have you, who had to leave like Monday or Tuesday of this week. And it's, I don't know all of the personal circumstances that are around that. I also know that a fair number of people who are gonna be here both weeks at the last minute couldn't make it at all. In the case of Tress Herzfeld, she had to have surgery, and her husband, Will, had to, of course, stay home related to that. And Dean T. Simon Ferrazzani from South Africa, who is just an extraordinary figure. Those of us who've been around him and met him think a lot about what Bonhoeffer during the Nazi Germany was like. Ferrazzani is in a kind of similar role in South Africa. He had to go back to the kind of torture treatment center in Minneapolis to deal with some of the lingering aspects of his imprisonment. And Purvis Short, who's a professional basketball player, now with the Houston Rockets, I almost said Astros, but that's the wrong sport. And formerly the Golden State Warrior. Incidentally, one of many hats that Will Herzfeld has worn over the years is a chaplain of the professional basketball team in Oakland, the Golden State Warriors. Although it's interesting that the three players that he was probably closest to, Purvis Short and Jobari Carroll and Sleepy Floyd, are now with the Houston team, and when J.B. Carroll was traded for Ralph Sampson, he called Will and said that the rumor was that they're trading soon for the captain, for the chaplain, and the trade would involve future considerations.
Well, I question whether bringing high-powered people by itself will accomplish much. This is the thing.
That's a good question, I think.
I mean, they're fine if they're a magnet to attract others, but so far I'm examining, have we accomplished much? This isn't the first year. You're seeing what's happened this year. What's happened this year going very far on the road?
I'm not sure. And there, in a way, it's not natural at all to 2 weeks say we're going to get a bunch of rainbow people up here and we're going to have the programming emphasizing that. but in a lot of other ways, Holden is not natural either. I mean, by its that's hard to say with this wonderful natural setting, but with its remoteness and in fact, the people here from Bethlehem last night were talking about getting some of the not so much leadership types of the congregation, but just regular families from the congregation up here next year. Yeah, it's a problem. I think there's a lot of work to do, shaping it better in the future would I'd be interested in what suggestions you might have in doing that.
Well, we've been looking. This is the point of my question.
Yeah.
I've worked on. I'm not a Lutheran. I'm a Methodist.
Uh huh.
Fairly well connected with the Methodist hierarchy in the Pacific Northwest, and working with some of the ones there, black and white, have tried to bring people completely unsuccessfully, by the way. And I don't know how we do it.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Bob, but I think the question is another helpful person to answer your Bob's question is probably Jody and Ingrid, who are working next year with Rainbow. And I think if I understand your question, is all of us are very anxious in who are interested in Rainbow to see the guests more. You're saying guests of color, and I think that there was a great effort on all the organizational part, and I think. This is only the second year. Mm-hmm. I think we've made great advancements, but I think the reality of it happening is going to take a lot of work by all, but I think Ingrid and Jody can probably speak to that more, and some of the people that were scheduled to come, why they couldn't come, and also the reality of how it could happen. I was talking to James, for instance, and he is so excited, the musician, mm-hmm. about bringing his family next year. And then I said, well, and about your parishioners? And he said, yeah, we'll figure out the $400 round trip airfare to start with.
Yeah.
And you know, and then, and there can be help. And I think, and I'm speaking only because I don't think there's anyone here who is on the planning of that, but unless you care and know about it. But Ingrid and Jody would be the ones that could help on that.
Yeah.
I think another thing too, I know two families specifically that were planning on coming and then last minute plans could not make it.
Yeah.
And so, but when you have a smaller, a minority of people that are coming up, it's much more noticeable. But I think things have come up this summer that a lot of people did not expect. I think the whole village too, there's fewer people here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think, you know, so I think that's, there's things that have just come up that have been unexpected. One thing I just want to say about, you know, I had these friends that came out last summer from Connecticut.
Yeah.
But it was my dad and I found out we were going to be on the teaching staff during the Rainbow Week. Oh, now I can get my friend out to the West Coast again. And they came up, but it was through a personal invitation to have them come out and then making the connections with Holden Village. And Holden Village even extended the invitation out to them, through the people that were working on it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a three-way thing that's working on it. So I think people have really tried to get people here. And you're right, it's not necessarily the high-powered people that are the ones that where we all benefit, but it's the people and the families that are invited.
Yes.
When I came in last Thursday, I was so happy to see. I have not been here at Rainbow before. I was just happy to see a change with some blacks. However contrived it may have been, I think perhaps maybe in the future it will be more natural. Mm-hmm. Number two, because I enjoyed the music, Nancy and James was just delightful. Number three, the children. To watch the children, they are so natural.
And yeah,
so
at least
that's. And we must think of the children, I think. They're carefully taught, really. So that's just it's an atmosphere. We have not been able to visit as much as we'd like, but then we can't contrive that either, I suppose. And if we had more, that perhaps would be easier.
I think a lot of personal contact is going to be very important inside the organization. But financial is a big one.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. It's a biggie. Yes.
You know, one need not concentrate on blacks in California or halfway across the country. It only costs 2 tanks of gas and a boat trip from Seattle. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people there that need help too. So.
I believe there's also some people working on getting people here from Tacoma also. Yeah, and I mean, there's, you know, two people that I know that are on the board that are right in the work right at the center.
We didn't even know it was Rainbow Week until we got up
here.
We don't even, we weren't aware of the calendar. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We could invite people. It's not knowing when this takes place. Right.
Oh, I might suggest, one lady asked me today how she could know what's going on at Holden between her visits. And I suggested she subscribe to the Holden Village newsletter, which is called
Accent. I think.
Yeah. And you can subscribe to that through, I think, for $6. And that would give you an idea of what's coming up. It helps me a lot, I know.
I don't think anything's real firm, but I heard that next year Rainbow is likely to be in July. And that's partially because in August the ELCA is having its national convention, where the divestment issue in South Africa is going to be horrendously big, unfortunately. We were also talking about trying to get Bethlehem's choir up here. And so.
You know what, I visiting Seattle before coming here and reading the newspaper, it happened to be a whole section on how blacks seem to feel so comfortable in Seattle metropolitan area. And I think your suggestion there, whoever is in Seattle and outlying areas, it seems like they would be more of a natural to maybe focus our invitations and contacts on simply financially, and then because they seem to integrate so well with everything.
Sometimes I think it's a problem because this may not be something that inner city people look to as something fun to do.
Mm-hmm. Or it,
something rustic in mountains doesn't appeal.
Yeah, or just, I mean, to me, and I've had friends who've been here for years and years that I've known for a long time who've talked about it. I didn't really have an idea what it was like until I got here. And a lot of people are concerned about whether certain things that are necessities are up here. And I, when Tress Hertzfeld first asked me whether I might be able to come, I had to talk about necessities and wondered if I could play basketball on it. I can do 2 weeks without all sorts of other things.
Would your basketball playing friends like this?
Partially, it would depend on whether the court was up all the time, real frankly. Because
24 hours a day.
Well, yeah, that'd be ideal.
Or if the courts would let them leave the city.
and partially would be... I doubt if any of them have ever been involved in hikes and that sort of thing in this kind of, I mean, it's just extraordinary, but backpackers of the world are probably as wide a group as you can find. If they had some people they knew up here, I think they would quickly adjust.
Well,
and
they're relatively small percentage of white people would be at home, and probably not too big a percentage of Lutherans.
Yeah, that's...
So it's not surprising that there are many blacks or people of other color.
Much less than that.
Yeah.
if I may suggest, we've talked a little about Holden and naturalness of bridges. I wonder if any of you have comments about your own life back where you come from, and building those bridges. And you talked in Sammy's session the other day about a black friend that you made in high school that you wasn't real sure how that happened that you became friends, but you did, and it's still. So I just wonder other things in life away from Holden.
Well, what could be more natural than marriage within the family?
Sure.
And I just feel that you know, it's the whole philosophy, or we've talked at Holden about rushing across the world to serve somebody when somebody right in your own neighborhood, mm-hmm. you could befriend, and maybe our own neighbor needs help with the fence. And I think my encouragement would be in a very small level is that, hey, when these things happen, which are so, quote, natural, mm-hmm. people fall in love. And we have these interracial marriages.
And that happened with our daughter, didn't it?
Yes, we have a wonderful biracial or interracial marriage and two beautiful grandchildren. And yet, as grandparents, we had a choice of how we could react to that.
Sure.
And we put it in the Lord's hands. And I just need to say, it's probably the most significant, joyful thing. But if we could have turned that all around, and I really, if I ever had a role, it would be to encourage people to start at that natural point of the music, the sports, and the families.
Yeah.
And it's just been probably more, I still get chills about it, but and I'm sure there's surprises still ahead. And there are things that I don't know how to do and deal with that I'm learning from some of my Black friends up here with our grandchildren.
Sure.
It's a big challenge in order that their future will be as joyful as it's made up.
Other comments or questions, please don't all speak at once.
It's kind of interesting that we are concentrating on the Blacks rather than other racial minorities. I've thought of some people of other brown races, particularly the friends of ours, they'd like it up here, but I'm not going to invite them specifically for a period of time that's designed to attract Blacks if it were trying to attract them. Racial minorities generally.
I know that next year there's more talk of emphasizing Asians especially, but there's a almost necessarily haphazard quality to how this all develops, I think. I'm sure there's all minorities, Latino and whatever, as much as possible, being in the rainbow would be highly desired.
But it has to be a developing process.
Sure.
It takes time.
Yeah.
If you're going to have a natural thing at all. And they're going to be uncomfortable, and you're going to be uncomfortable for a while in many mm-hmm. cases.
Unless they're like the Hertzfield folks. They're not uncomfortable anywhere. Somebody up here once said that Will sucks the air out of the room when he walks in, and somebody else said, yes, but Tress puts it back in.
I'll have to quote that.
But just the awareness of the people in the camp here will carry a lot of weight, it seems to me, that may not be visible to the actual program here, but in the long run it will have an effect.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other? Yes.
Yeah, it may seem like it is kind of a natural, keep bringing people in, but how many of us are from predominantly white communities and don't have that, there's not even an opportunity to know people
sure.
of other colors.
Although it's been fascinating to me to hear people talking from Minnesota about the number of Cambodians or Laotians or someone else was talking about Afghanistani refugees. There's increasingly this country all over is becoming multi. Cultural, whether people like it or not, in lots of different ways. But there obviously still are a lot of communities that are overwhelmingly of one racial group. Well, if we're all through with our comments, I thought I would like to play one more number on this tape. If you want to stay, you're welcome to it. It's it'll take me a bit to find it, but it's a New Orleans hymn called Just a Closer Walk with Thee, often used as a funeral kind of hymn down there. And the way this is developed, it was the first verse is sung in a real straight kind of manner, and then all sorts of stuff starts happening. So, and thank you all for coming. Walk with me.